It is so good to see everybody. We're going to begin this morning with a reading of Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. And so if you'll turn there, we'll get to that first thing. Matthew chapter 5, 13 to 16. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. If you were asked to define what a good man is, how would you go about doing that? Well, if you ever are asked that question, I would recommend you turn to Matthew chapter 5 and list the qualities of the man we've been looking at for the past few weeks from verses 3 through 12. A good man is a humble man. He is a man who has a tender conscience. He's a man who is under control. He's a man who is never satisfied with the status quo. He's always wanting something better. He realizes there's always room for improvement, and he strives in that area. He is a merciful man. He is a man trying to purify his life of sin. He's a man who brings peace and not disputations and wars to individuals. That's a good man, but even more, that kind of a man is a man of the kingdom. He's in the kingdom of God. He's in the kingdom of heaven. And to be in the kingdom of God, to be in the kingdom of heaven, they are synonymous terms, means that there is one guiding rule in your life. And I think that rule is given in Matthew, the 6th chapter, in that part that we call the Lord's Prayer. It starts out, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." That's how the kingdom comes. The word kingdom means to rule, to reign, to govern. How does God's rule come to our life? It's by saying, "Thy will be done." A Christian is a person who has made the determination that in their life, they're going to let God's will be the guiding factor. When I was a young preacher and I'd brought someone to the point of baptism by teaching and studying with them, I would always, before I baptized them, spend a lesson or two talking about the church. I wanted to make sure they understood. Now, if you're going to be baptized, that means you're going to be here on Sundays, and we have a midweek Bible study that you don't want to miss. You're going to be here for that also. And those were the kinds of things I was really emphasizing. Now, looking back on those years, I would have done it completely differently. What I would have emphasized is this. If you're going to be baptized, here's the lifestyle you are committing yourself to being humble, to having a tender conscience, to being under control. I would have gone through all of that, and I would have pointed out, if you're not willing for the will of God to be your governing principle, then you're not ready to be baptized into Christ. And so a good man is a kingdom man, but a good man is not good for nothing. And in verses 13 through 16 this morning, we're going to see what a good man is good for. Christ never said something was good without telling us what it's good for. And that's what we have in verses 13 through 16. We have some metaphors that describe what kingdom men, what good men are good for. And we're going to look at these today under three subheads. We're going to talk about the Christian's inherent fitness, and about his divine intention, and about his moral obligation. A Christian's inherent fitness is that of preservation. His divine intention is that of revelation. His moral obligation is that of illumination. And those are the three points that I see made in these verses that I just read. So let's begin by talking about a Christian's inherent fitness. You are the salt of the earth. That's our inherent fitness. Now I want to mention at least three things that salt does. I think all of these fit with this metaphor that we are the salt of the earth. I want to talk about the task that salt fulfills, and then the taste that salt imparts, and then the thirst that salt creates. So let's first off talk about the task that salt fulfills. Possibly the biggest thing that salt does in regard to its task is that of preservation. Salt preserves. It's a universal antiseptic. It keeps things from going bad. You know what part of the earth has the highest concentration of salt? It's not the salt mines, where they're down there digging and freeing sodium chloride from the earth. No, the greatest concentration of salt is in the ocean. Salt water. And I didn't think about this till I was reading about it the other day. The salt water in the oceans has a tremendous purifying influence on the entire planet. Now, it certainly has a purifying influence on the beaches. Listen, if the water in the ocean was not salt water, nobody would want to live near the beach. The only reason people want to have a home on the beach now is because of the purification process that the salt in the ocean, the salt water, does. I mean, it doesn't let things just lay there and rot forever and ever and ever. It dissolves them, it sanitizes them, it keeps the beaches clean, and that affects all the areas around the beach. And that's what salt does. It is the greatest natural purifying force in the world, salt. That was one of the reasons why it was so valuable in the ancient world. I mean, those fishermen there in the Sea of Galilee, they knew that if they were going to preserve the fish they caught, get it to market, have it be sold, used in homes, they were going to have to preserve that fish. That Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. It gets really hot and humid down there. And things that are not preserved rot very quickly. So the apostles, those were the fishermen, they knew the preserving power of salt. And in the life of a Christian, Christian character is an antiseptic in human society. And it preserves in a number of ways. A Christian character is going to awaken the conscience of people that it comes in contact with. It's going to produce shame in the people it comes in contact with. It's going to make people feel badly about the kind of people they are. It will even cause them to mourn. Blessed are they who mourn. And one of the ways that the shame a Christian character produces in others is seen is in regard to their language. Have you ever had someone apologize for their language around you? Now, I'm going to fess up to something here. I play pickleball once a week, and I sometimes cuss during pickleball. If I hit the ball into the net, you know, when I should, I cuss. And here's my cuss word. Phooey gumdrops. Now, every time I cuss like that, people around me start laughing. And I feel the need to apologize, so I'll say, excuse my French, you know, when I say phooey gumdrops. But more than once it's happened in my experience that somebody has used the Lord's name in vain. They've used some four-letter word they shouldn't use. It gets out before they can stop it because that's just the way they talk. And realizing I don't talk like that or you don't talk like that, it shames them. And when that happens, that's Christian character exercising a preservative effect a sanitizing effect. Personally, socially, politically, morally, spiritually, Christian character wields a huge restorative influence on the unforgiven people around us. That's the task of salt. Now, what about the taste of salt? Salt improves taste. If you've ever had bland soup, you know that. If you've ever tried to eat a potato without salt, you know that. Salt makes things taste better. And the Christian life does that with life in general. The Christian life is not a bland, insipid, dull life. When a Christian who is salt is around, here's the kinds of situations that happen. People begin to think when they're in contact with a Christian. By what the Christian believes, by how the Christian lives, they are challenging the way the world is, and that causes people to think. And people start forming opinions about life when a Christian is around. I forget who the skeptic was, the ancient skeptic, but one time one of those ancient skeptics made the comment about the spread of Christianity in the Roman Empire. He said, "Bah, even the slaves are starting to think." Christianity does that. When a Christian is around, people not only start to think, they start to evaluate the life they're living. They start to compare the life they're living with the life they know they ought to live. Sometimes, because of Christian character, people will curse you and defame you and blaspheme you. And like Christ said last week, say all kinds of evil things about you for my name's sake. Sometimes that's the way it happens. In the New Testament, when Christian character came into a community, sometimes riots broke out. Sometimes Christians were arrested. Sometimes they were persecuted. But Christianity is not a non-influence in a society where it's found. Sometimes, because of Christian character coming into a situation, people found joy. And they found peace. They found life-changing hope. And they were no longer a sinking ship. There was a spring to their step because they came in contact with a Christian. Christianity flavors life. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. Christians should always be capable of having interesting conversations if they are the salt of the earth. And thirdly, salt produces thirst. You've heard the expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. That's right, but you can give him salt. And you give him salt, and the drinking will take care of itself. A Christian man's life will draw people to Christ. Will make Christ more attractive to people. A Christian life entices people. It does not drive them away. So, salt does all of that. But what if salt loses its savor? Christ talks about that. Now, salt, sodium chloride, is a very NaCl, is a very stable chemical compound. It's almost impossible for those two atoms to split from one another in nature. But salt can lose its saltiness, its savor, its flavor, by becoming contaminated with impurities. And oftentimes when you would find your stash of salt had become contaminated in some way, you know, they would throw it out on the ground. Before long, the salt would dissolve and it would just be the impurities left there. And the only evidence of the salt left behind would be a whitish kind of powder that wasn't salt. That was just evidence that salt had been there one time. That's what happens to salt that loses its savor. It's thrown out. There are two Bibles that are available for this world to read. One Bible is the one that, you know, we hold in our hands that we can read. The other Bible is our life. And people who won't read this Bible will read the Bible that is us. And when in reading our life, when in observing our life, taking note of our life, they realize we who claim to be Christian aren't Christian at all, they will have no use for us. There is nothing the world has less use for than someone who claims to be a Christian but is not, in fact, a Christian, because their life gives lie to the claim that they're a Christian. When a Christian has lost his saltiness, Christ said, he is good for nothing. That doesn't mean he can't go to work and serve his employer. But as far as eternity is concerned, as far as helping people to heaven, he is good for nothing. We need to be careful about the kind of Bible we are that people are going to read. And so our inherent function is to be preservatives, giving flavoring, creating thirst, people to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, what is our divine intention? What does God intend for us to be? He says, you are the light of the world. And it's emphatic, just like with salt. You, not the rotary, not the school system, not the politicians, nobody else is the light of the world. You Christians and you only are the light of the world. How important is light? Well, next time you have a power outage, think about that. You know, we had some storms go through here a couple of weeks ago and our lights in town went out. And they stayed out, and I'd gotten my neighbor lady, Denise, and we'd gone over to my cousin's to go down to the basement because of the threat. And while we were over at my cousin's, the lights go out, and so I finally took Denise home, hoping we'd find candles. She had no candles, and the power hadn't come on. She had a flashlight. So she took the flashlight, went back to her bedroom. Denise is 90, 91. You know, she went back to her bedroom. I just sat on the couch. I just sat there. There was no light. I didn't have a flashlight. I could have used my phone, but I wouldn't have had my phone very long if I'd used that flashlight. I just sat there in the dark. And I had some things to think about that I could do some meditating on. That was good. But, I mean, it's miserable not to have any light. And light does not exist for its own sake. Light does not exist so that we'll look at the light. Light exists to enable us to look at other things, other objects. And the Christian light is meant to help us see the darkness of life. You know, it's kind of curious. We talk about the speed of light. Light is an active force in nature. It is radioactive. It moves. We know how fast it moves. I mean, it is a potent force. But in regard to nature, I never had a class in school talking about the speed of darkness. Because in nature, darkness is not active. It's just dark. It's just that, and that's it. It doesn't move around anywhere. But now morally, it's different. In the moral realm, in the spiritual realm, darkness is active. And darkness is at work. And darkness is extinguished to turn out the light. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. The God of this world has blinded the hearts of men so that they don't see the light. Darkness is active. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers, the power of darkness. We wrestle against. We fight the good fight against. Now, the true light only comes from one place, and that's from heaven, that's from God. Christ said, I am the light of the world. And what he says to us is, you are to be reflective of my light. You're to be the light of the world. You're to be such light that you're like a city set on a hill that people can see from a long way off. Have you ever flown at night? I've flown all over the place at night, and it's always interesting when I'm flying south and I'm going over the mountains, the Appalachians down there in the south, and it's dark, and it's not like flying around over the prairie where you can see lights everywhere. Flying over the mountains, there may be one little spot of light here, and maybe way over here another little spot. And those little spots of light may be nothing but pole lights. They're not skylights. No, they're not big beams. They're just a little pole light out in front of the farmhouse that somebody struck. And yet, from 30,000 feet, you can see it. And that's the only thing you can see. And Christ says that we are the light of the world. We're meant to make things visible. It wasn't the philosophers who were the light of the world, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, not them. It wasn't the Roman lawmakers, the Roman Senate that was the light of the world, not the ancient writers, not the ancient architects. The only true light is that which came from Christ. And people of just ordinary status, ordinary common sense, who came to put their trust in Him. They may not know anything about AI, but they know AD. They know that this is the year of the Lord, Anno Domini, and that they're going to represent Him to the world. Christians are the light of the world. And then that leads to the third point, our moral obligation. Paul in Philippians 2:15 says that we are to shine as lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. We're to be like the stars in this world. And our purpose in shining is to enable God to be seen. Now, light shines because that's what light does. Light shines. But light shines on something. And the light that we are is meant to shine on the love and grace of God. We are to make the love and grace of God as conspicuous to those around us as we possibly can. We're going to be that pole light in the midst of all the world's darkness. We shine because that's what we do. The object that we illuminate by our shining is God, the Father who is in heaven. You know, the angels glorify God they see. We men right now glorify God we can't see, except as people reflect His love and His grace. And so our object is to draw the attention of men to God, to enable them to see God. There was an old story from the 19th century, 1885, somewhere around there, written by a man by the name of Pater, called Marius the Epicurean. The Epicurean were one of the schools of philosophers. And Marius, in this story and set back in ancient times, is trying to investigate all the different kinds of philosophies and religions to see which one is really the one he ought to embrace. And in the story, Marius comes in contact with a soldier by the name of Cornelius, who was in the 12th Legion. Roman legion, but he was a Christian. And Marius was around him, and eventually Marius said this about his life. His life was like a sign or symbol of some other thing far beyond it. And that's such a great commentary, I think, on verse 16. That by our good works that people see, we don't do them to put ourselves on display, we do them so that people will see someone far beyond us. That child song, "This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine." is what the Christian is to do. The Christian is the only force in this world that can overcome darkness. Light is needed, and the Christian light has God magnifying power, enabling God to be seen in all of His grace and love and mercy. So, we're to be the salt of the earth. We're to be the light of the world. We are to make God visible to people. That's the great statement of Matthew 5:13-16.